the weakening of the multilateral trade system, obviously bad news for the global economy as a whole, but particularly bad news for developing economies.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. We think of global trade, hyper-globalization, as having created many growth miracles since the 1990s, but is that the full story? If we look at the source of these miracles more closely, will that help us to understand how the geopolitical and technology shifts of the last decade have affected and will continue to affect the relationship between international trade and development? Penny Goldberg of Yale and Michele Ruta of the International Monetary Fund are the authors of a chapter in the forthcoming Handbook of Development Economics on this topic. And they both join me now. So welcome to Vox Dev Talks, Penny.
Hi, Tim. Thank you very much for having us.
And Michele as well.
Hello. Hi. Good to see you again.
It's great to talk to both of you again. In this work, you are distinguishing very early on between the static and the dynamic gains from trade. That's what you call it. Now, you're skeptical that the static gains tell the full story of how trade drives development, which I think many people might assume. What are these static gains and why are you skeptical?
Let me back off for a second to emphasize that this work was done in the context of, Tim, as you said, the Handbook of Development Economics. And so we wanted to take stock of where development is today, but also what the challenges for the future are and how likely is it that what we've experienced in the past is going to repeat itself in the future. So when it comes to trade in particular and globalization more generally, it has been credited with some of the growth miracles we experienced in the previous decades, especially in East Asia. And this is perhaps reflected in the term export-led growth. As you said, we are skeptical that you can explain these growth miracles through the channels of static comparative advantage. There is a voluminous work in trade that has emphasized that trade can generate income gains and growth, but our point is it's very hard to generate growth miracles through these channels. And by static here, we mean essentially mechanisms that take a country's endowments, so physical and human capital, for example, technology and institutions as given. And then the main channel through which trade achieves an improvement of income or welfare more generally is through static comparative advantage, through specialization, through reallocation of resources. If you put these mechanisms through quantitative trade models that have flourished in the last decade, both old and new models, it's very hard to generate the numbers that we see in practice. So to give you one example, Korea's GDP per capita grew 30-fold in the last few decades between the 1960s and the 2000s. And it's very hard for a trade model to generate these. There are ways to do it, but it's very hard. Also, from a practical point of view, if you look at a country like Mexico that has been very open to trade, it did grow very fast, but eventually it hit a stopping point. It stagnated, it hit this middle income trap. And so trade can explain growth through static channels, but it cannot explain these miracles that we've seen in the past. We emphasize instead what we call the dynamic channels.
Right. So explain what these dynamic channels are and what their impact can be.
Under dynamic channels, we define mechanisms that change a country's endowments, human capital, for example. They change technologies, productivity, and they also change institutions. In the handbook chapter, we explain in detail which mechanisms in particular we have in mind in the context of trade. So we are thinking of access to big markets, markets with high purchasing power that allow countries to achieve a critical threshold of market size so that they could adopt new technologies. We understand the process of learning, of knowledge sharing, of technology transfer across borders, and also a change in institutions. So these are all channels that set dynamic processes in motion that fundamentally change the structure of an economy. And it's our thesis in this chapter that these channels have been much more consequential for growth. This is what created the growth miracles of the past. Then we asked the question, what were the conditions for these growth miracles to realize? And we identified three main sets of conditions. One was technologies, the ability to take a production process, split it up into little parts, and then outsource some of these parts to other countries that led to the emergence and growth of global value chains, the very sharp decline in transportation and communication costs, containers. So these are all technological change. Equally important are policy changes. So most importantly, the embracing of multilateralism, of liberal trade regimes, the fact that most advanced countries stayed away from industrial policy in the past, and also geopolitical stability that generated predictability and stability. So all these trade developments, global value chains, and so on could actually flourish. And it's our main thesis that all these preconditions are being eroded right now. So we end up quite pessimistic about the prospect of generating growth miracles in the future. We still believe that growth is possible, but growth miracles seem less likely because two of the key mechanisms, so access to big markets, big lucrative markets, and this willingness to share knowledge, to share technology across borders, these seem to no longer be here.
Let's talk in a little bit more detail about how some of these mechanisms have worked. Now, access to those large markets that we got from globalization and trade liberalization, how did that change the process of development beyond simply giving you access to more customers that we'd think in those static gains? How did those dynamic gains play out?
Apart from the obvious effect that you have access to more consumers, if we think about development as involving the transition from a more traditional technology to a modern technology, this modern technology requires fixed costs. And by modern technology, we don't necessarily mean AI or chips production, but simply the marketization of an economy. You move economic activity from the household to firms. All this requires paying some fixed costs. And for a very poor country and for a very small economy, it's very hard to cover these fixed costs because there is no domestic market. So you need a critical market size before you can cover these fixed costs. If you have very large countries like China, India, Indonesia, they can achieve this on their own. It would probably take more time than it took in practice, but in principle, they can do it. Go to the other extreme, Singapore or Taiwan. These are tiny economies. There, it's obvious that you need the larger market in order to be able to pay these fixed costs and adopt new technologies. Most countries are not as small as Singapore, but they are small in the global context. And for all these countries, this access to large markets, to a big customer base, is quite important as a first step towards having the ability to cover fixed costs. And it's especially important early in the development when they are really poor. As they develop, as they grow richer, as they develop the domestic market, they have a larger middle class, they can rely more and more on their own markets. But when they are really poor, this is crucial. That's one channel.
And as during the process of development, these countries are using these ability to invest and upgrade their skills, what sort of commitment does that require from both sides for this to be able to happen?
That's a very interesting question. So another channel we emphasize is that as countries develop, then it's not just about having access to large markets. It's also about upgrading your technology, you know, learning, improving your processes, your products, your labor force, and so on. That happens in many ways. So first, many countries invest explicitly in human capital. They adopt educational policies that raise the educational level of the population. One example is Korea. And now, of course, many people will say, well, this is human capital investment, this is not trade. But the point we make is that trade created the demand conditions that made these human capital investments worthwhile. Maybe without the demand and the jobs that trade had created, it would not have been advantageous to policymakers to adopt these policies. In addition to that, there is a lot of learning that happens organically through trade. There is a large literature on learning through exporting and importing. There is also substantial evidence on how global value chains promoted this learning. Because when you split up the production process and one part is produced in one country and another part in another country, you need to make sure that these parts are compatible. So firms need to communicate across borders. They need to talk, they need to make their products compatible. Through this process, they exchange knowledge. And as they exchange knowledge, they also upgrade each other's skills. So that happens organically to a certain extent. And then there is also explicit technology transfer. This has a bad name these days. We often call it technology extraction or quid pro quo arrangements. But there are also many cases where countries said, if you want to invest in our country, then you actually need to share your technology with us explicitly. And this has actually been quite important to develop. Now, to answer your question, what conditions do we need for that? Well, fundamentally, you need for both sides to agree that this knowledge sharing is desirable and you need an appreciation for it. And that was the case in the previous decades. This was an era where most firms were driven by profit, by economic efficiency, and governments embraced that. And so if a German or an American firm wanted to do business in China, maybe it had to share technology. But ultimately, this was profit maximizing to them. It was good for Germany. It was good for the American firms. It was also good for China. And everyone played along. There was also a fundamental belief that trade and economic welfare are not a zero-sum game. So China may benefit, Korea may benefit, but ultimately we all benefit. So there was this fundamental belief that when you pursue economic profit, economic efficiency, ultimately everyone may be better off. In our view, this was more important than anything. In addition to that, in order to have these arrangements, you also need to be able to trust your other partners. So you need stability, you need predictability. So Michele can talk much more about how the trade institutions actually created this environment, but you need to be able to know what's coming tomorrow. And again, in the previous decades, we had this predictability. This is equally important. This is something that's perhaps hard to stick into a trade model and quantify its importance. But there is no question that it played a very important role in this emergence of global value chains. And also, more importantly, this knowledge sharing that has happened in the past. And again, our point is that all this is being eroded right now.
Penny, it's hard for people who weren't around at the time to conceive, I would imagine, about how much technology transfer was going on during peak globalization. It would be inconceivable for some of it to happen today. Why were people just not worried about it?
Partly because the main objective was economic profit. It was profit and economic efficiency. And this was also a time after the Cold War had ended. So we all bet on peace and stability. We were not worried about geopolitics, geopolitical tensions. We took that as given. Even when we started experiencing a backlash against globalization and many worries about the resilience of supply chains and so on, there was still a very strong belief among the trade community that what we had achieved was so important that there was no way back, that this knowledge transfer, this high specialization would continue forever. It was inevitable, it was unavoidable, and there would be too much to lose by reverting to a different regime. And I think those who believe that were proven wrong.
Michele, I want to talk to you about multilateral institutions and the roles that they have played in this. I mean, clearly we think about the World Trade Organization, but many other multilateral institutions had a hand in this as well. What sort of hand did they have in this beyond just clearly setting the rules?
Setting the rules is obviously very, very important. And if we think about the WTO, the first thing that comes to mind is the fact that it has been instrumental in lowering tariffs and therefore lowering trade costs. But I think beyond that, there are some very important things that the WTO and the multilateral rules-based trade system did that are very easy to miss. The first thing is that if you think about it, the alternative to the rules-based trade system is a power-based system. And a power-based system is much more unpredictable. And as we all know by experience, in a power-based system, the larger countries tend to have the upper hand. And so a rules-based system basically protects the smaller and developing countries. And just to give you an example, one of the pillars of the WTO is the most favored nation rule, or MFN. What does it say? Basically, it says that if a country gives a tariff concession to a large partner, it has to extend that concession to everyone else. And so this clearly protects the small economies in asymmetries in tariff bargaining. Now, the second aspect that sometimes gets overlooked is that the WTO and regional trade agreements as well tend to have an important commitment role. So when policymakers try to implement some changes that are good for the economy as a whole, but may affect some special interests in particular, it may be difficult. And the WTO and the regional trade agreements have provided a commitment device that has helped making these welfare-improving reforms. So I think, in general, the weakening of the multilateral trade system, the rules-based trade system that we are seeing now, and one big example of this is the troubles that there have been at the dispute settlement at the WTO. Mm-hmm. Those are obviously bad news for the global economy as a whole, but particularly bad news for developing economies.
And as Penny was saying, that it was seen that trade, I mean, it wasn't just happening in spite of political differences, but it was a route to a political reconciliation, if you like. There was the idea that if we all traded together, then we would get along together as well. Other examples of that that helped growth, but which politically just would not fly today.
Especially after the end of the Cold War, we had the relative geopolitical stability, and there was a consensus around the importance of the multilateral trade institutions. And that was instrumental for trade growth and the growth of global value chains. Now, because the logic was that economic efficiency was to be prioritized over other things, that led to very intense trade relationships, even between countries that were very different politically. And obviously, the first one that comes to mind is US and China, because those are two systems that are very different from a political point of view. The point that we're trying to make here is that the efficiency argument for trade cooperation remains as valid as before. What has changed is that this cooperation is more difficult in practice, and developing countries may, in fact, be caught in the middle of these rivalries between large players.
So let's have a look at what happens next. The story we've been talking about from the period of hyperglobalization up to today has been mostly about goods. But we have digitization now in many areas of how trade is done. That creates an environment where services can be traded more easily. Could this have a similar transformative impact in the future?
So that's the billion-dollar question, I think.
Yes.
We try to see it from both sides, the optimistic and the more cautious side. On the optimistic side, it has been true that services trade has been growing quite fast. If we focus on digital products like streaming movies, this has been very dynamic. So there was a study by the WTO and other institutions that showed that on average in the past 20 years, the growth of this digital trade was 8% per year. And still on the optimistic side, many of the business or IT services, they have the same type of firm-to-firm collaboration or knowledge transfer that have been important for manufacturing global supply chains. Now, there are many reasons, though, to be cautious. So let me just mention three. The first one is that many of these promising tradable services are quite skill intense. You need to have language skills, you need to have IT skills. Mm-hmm. And so in order to be successful there, you also need to have an important investment in human capital. That's very different from the experience we've seen in manufacturing. The second reason to be cautious is policy. Many advanced economies and many economies in general tend to have services that are more regulated than goods trade. There are many domestic regulations that limit the ability of countries to export into those markets services. So that may change, But, you know, as many people say, the future of trade may be in services, maybe also the future of trade protectionism is going to be in services. If there is a risk that jobs in advanced economies will be impacted, that also implies that the services regulations may remain high or even go up. And then the last reason to be cautious is that services trade may generate positive spillovers on the rest of the economy. But whether these positive spillover effects on the rest of the economy are sufficient to create the same type of transformation that we have seen with manufacturing, there remains an important question that so far has no answer. The bottom line is that services trade will likely be increasingly important. Whether it can generate the kind of export-led growth miracle is much more difficult to answer.
Hyperglobalization also created those very long global value chains. We found out later, especially during COVID, that disruptions to one element in the chain can create large disruptions to the global economy. And many countries in the global south are those that are most vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. Will this in future affect their ability to create transformation in their economies through trade?
In my view, this claim that the COVID pandemic exposed the vulnerability of global value chains is misguided.
Uh-huh.
It's absolutely clear that supply chains suffered, but I would take the word global out. If anything, global supply chains proved incredibly resilient and would have been much worse off without the global supply chains. I would like to give one example that comes from the Pfizer CEO, Birla, who pointed out that in order to produce the Pfizer vaccine, you needed 65 ingredients that came from 14 different countries, and that was at the height of the pandemic. So it's absolutely true that the supply chains experienced a crisis, but if you think about the big crisis we had in the United States on toilet paper, mostly paper goods, right? These were mostly domestic supply chains. They had nothing to do with global supply chains. But I'm very sympathetic to the point that global supply chains may not be resilient to geopolitical risk. That's different.
Uh-huh.
And that concern surfaced after the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. So to me, that was a game changer. And I accept that global supply chains have proven very vulnerable to geopolitics. And so there is a valid effort to diversify. There's no question about that.
Let me just say that I fully subscribe to what Penny just said on GBCs and resilience. It's a misconception that you see very often in the policy discussions here, even over here. Now, going back to the climate issue. So the first thing that comes to mind goes back to the static comparative advantage. This is because climate change is mostly going to affect sectors like tourism, agriculture, where developing economy, especially low-income countries, tend to specialize. So low-income countries, for instance, their exports, 50% of their exports are in agriculture, around 20% is tourism. So any disruption that climate change will have on these sectors will have important implications for trade of developing countries. But what we are trying to say consistently to what Penny discussed at the beginning of our conversation is that the dynamic forces are very important. And these dynamic forces were very much related to the fact that countries would integrate in global value chains. And through this integration in global value chains, we'd have knowledge and technology transfers that were fundamental for structural transformation. Because of climate change that affects particularly certain regions and certain countries within certain regions, those locations may become risky. And because they become risky, they are less likely to be targeted by multinational firms that try to open up new factories. And so the risk is that climate change may just create another layer of cost, of barrier for these countries to integrate into global value chains and therefore to benefit through trade.
Just to give a concrete example, if you're in a country that may be affected by tsunamis or hurricanes, you know, when the prospect of such destruction becomes more likely because of climate change, mm-hmm. it's less likely that global value chains would make that country part of the chain. So that's one concern. And that's why, again, we emphasize these dynamic channels, because from a static point of view, It's true, as Michele said, that because of agriculture and tourism, we would expect developing countries, poor countries, to be disproportionately affected. But actually, it's the IMF that has shown that there are also opportunities. So, for example, if you think about rare earths or some other minerals that are critical for green policies, there are many countries in Africa that are very richly endowed with such resources. So, in principle, green growth would also create demand for resources that are abundant in Africa. But then we are back to these static channels, to natural resources. And if anything, people talk about the natural resource curse, right? So yes, you may have all these endowments, all this abundance, but there is absolutely no guarantee that this will lead to growth and development.
Now, we've also seen the return, of course, of industrial policy, some of it targeted directly at trade. Can we know how much of this is just a temporary feature of global trade and how much is going to stick around permanently and so have an effect on this sort of structural transformation that we're talking about?
Here, my honest answer is that I have no idea what industrial policies will have a permanent impact on global trade. I think industrial policy is always a very tricky issue for economists. I think most economists agree with the fact that industrial policies can be helpful where there are market failures. Already when you move to the empirical analysis, there are many divergences of what industrial policies work and under what conditions. And here the problem is with the current situation is that there is a huge amount of uncertainty. These policies, of course, we see it especially in the US right now, are changing quite frequently. They may not always be fully consistent because they try to achieve different goals. So try to predict what impact they will have in the long term is difficult. What we can be more certain of is a couple of points. The first, and we discussed this in the chapter, is that the use of industrial policies has changed over time. We show new data starting in 2009 that shows that industrial policies have been on the rise. This is both for advanced and emerging economies, but especially after 2020, this increase in advanced economies has been particularly prominent. And now you go back, we don't have good data on industrial policies for the 90s or the early 2000s, but the general perception is that these were much less used by advanced economies, something that Penny was mentioning earlier. So there is this change in the policy spectrum. And then the second point is how these policies are used, especially in advanced economies, may affect the prospects of growth through trade in developing countries. And here, the typical example would be if the objective of a certain industrial policy is to relocate production of a certain product within the national borders, this obviously goes against the possibility of developing countries to access technologies and knowledge spillovers that come through supply chains and FDI. So there is a tension there that is likely going to complicate the path for developing economies.
One of the features of the impact of geopolitics has been more of an emphasis on trade blocks rather than global trade. Is this going to impact the process of development?
Definitely, yes. As Penny was discussing earlier, there are two things that are especially important for the dynamic gains. One is market access, and the other one is technology transfer. Now, the fragmentation into blocks will affect both. Market access is quite obvious. If you are not in the block, you don't have access to that market. Similarly, for the policies, if the objective of these industrial policies is to move production within national boundaries, then again, this reduces the possibility of technology transfer. So both these aspects that are associated to fragmentation would be a concern. A couple of additional points that are related to this. The first is, do we have any evidence that fragmentation is actually happening? There is a lot of discussion. The smoking gun is obviously the policies, but do we see it in the trade data? And there is some research that has highlighted that some of the fragmentation between rival blocs is already happening. After the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, there has been a decline in trade growth. This decline was much more evident between blocs that trade within blocks. So that's one piece of evidence that suggests that this fragmentation is happening. And of course, as we know, trade policies are changing as we speak. And so the jury is out how this will eventually impact global trade in the longer term. The second point that we try to make in the paper is that obviously these changes in policies that are associated to fragmentation also create a reallocation of global trade. And as trade reallocates, then it's possible that some countries actually benefit. If my competitor is out of the bloc while I'm within the bloc, my competition is reduced on my side. And there is evidence of that as well. Now, the question is this good news for developing countries and especially least developing countries? Now, if we look at what happened, especially with the US-China tariffs in 2018-19, we observed a lot of this reallocation and some countries gains, but the countries that gains were essentially the usual suspects. So countries like Vietnam, Mexico, Malaysia, these were countries that were already very well anchored into global supply chains, and they became even more integrated. The countries that are at the margins of global supply chains that were not integrated before did not gain any additional access. So the concern is that fragmentation will not necessarily create opportunities for least developing countries to integrate more.
After, you know, the tariffs of 2018-2019, many people said there's a lot of work by ourselves, among others, that show that actually many countries benefited in terms of exports from the tariffs. So one reaction was actually this has been good for many developing countries. This has been good news for trade. But actually the countries that did benefit were the countries that were already integrated in the world trading system. So if anything, this was an argument in favor of trade, not against trade and in favor of protection. We don't want to get into very recent politics, partly because these are very volatile. But this fragmentation along blocks, along block lines, this was the consensus in the literature until very recently. However, policies have changed very recently in a way that make even this view questionable, in the sense that the latest round of tariffs in the US target everyone. So not just countries that are not allied with the US, they target allies as much as non-allies. The future now is really unpredictable. Now the trade system is power-based. So the powerful countries are negotiating agreements with individual trade partners. It's hard to extrapolate from these bilateral agreements to how the world will look a year or two from now. Once again, we live at a time of very high volatility, unpredictability, and that itself has important implications for trade and development.
Quote from your paper, it appears increasingly unlikely that trade and globalization will offer the same pathways for rapid growth and development that they did in the past. Is it really the case, as you said at the beginning, Penny, no more growth miracles?
Growth miracles are not likely for developing countries. That doesn't mean that growth is impossible. It could be slower. In our view, they would have to rely more and more on their own domestic resources. So sound domestic policies are more important than ever. That said, the poorest countries, the low-income countries, still need foreign assistance. It's very hard to do it on their own, and that's where the big challenges are.
When you have these structural policies and these geopolitical changes, of course, the global economy will adjust in some form. So as multilateral institutions weaken, maybe we'll see the regional partnerships will matter more. As advanced economies raise their trade barriers, it's possible that South-South trade will become relatively more relevant. As technology changes, it's possible that services trade will become an increasingly more relevant share of world trade. The trade and development nexus will remain important in the future. But the conditions that were export-led growth miracles are changing. And this is why we are pessimistic about the fact that these miracles can repeat themselves in the future.
It's pessimism, but it's well-founded. Thank you very much for talking about it. Thank you, Penny.
Thank you very much.
And Michele as well.
Thank you.
The paper is called The Changing Nature of International Trade and Its Implications for Development. The authors, Penny Goldberg and Michele Ruta, you've heard from both of them. If you don't want to wait for the handbook, then you can find it as NBER Working Paper 34283. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. All our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org, where you will also find articles about the topics that we feature on Vox Dev Talks. If you like what you're hearing, please tell someone else about us and leave us a review. Vox Dev Talks is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber and our editor is Andrei Zargarian. Thanks to Oliver Hanni and Iman Siddiq at Vox Dev.